You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is sponsored by Codify, a California benefit corporation. Visit Codify at www.codify.com. Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, Episode 9. I'm Chris Webster.
And I'm April Camp Whitaker. On today's show, we're going to be talking to archaeologist Stuart Rathbone about his work in Ireland and a little bit about cultural resource management archaeology in Ireland.
Let's dig a little deeper. Right, we're here on the Archaeology Show, and we've got with us today a guest. It's somebody I've known online for a while, but now he lives in Reno, so we meet occasionally. Stuart Rathbone, how's it going?
Nice, good, Chris.
Good. So we actually met for lunch the other day in Reno, and we were talking about some of the research Stuart is doing and some other things, and I thought it'd be great to get him on the show to talk about what he's doing. So Stuart, why don't you give the audience an introduction and a little bit about yourself?
Okay, well, I guess I'm a jobbing archaeologist. I'm English. I was born in England anyway. And I went to school in Bournemouth. I did the archaeology BSc. So it's quite an unusual degree because it's very science-based. And as soon as I graduated, I moved to Ireland. I got my first job doing commercial work on big road schemes in Ireland. And I did that for 8 or 9 years. I did some really fantastic investigations over there. Big Bronze Age settlement sites and stuff.
Nice.
And then slowly sort of moved more into research work as the big economic crash really hit Irish archaeology hard, just as I was changing the sort of focus of my career anyway. So then I spent, I don't know, 7 or 8 years running a field school, doing training excavations, digging up a mixture of Bronze Age sites, 19th century sites, so quite a range there on an island off the west coast of Ireland. So that was really fun. I did some work for one of the universities, sort of working through legacy archives to do with a big project in northwest Ireland of the Cager Fields, which is just hitting the news at the moment because they've been reinterpreted, but they're a big Neolithic field system. Really extensive archaeology, so got to work with some really great material there. And then spent a year up in the Shetlands, which is practically in Scandinavia. So that was good as well. Got to work on that Nessa Brodgar excavation for a bit, which you might have seen, the big Neolithic temple site on the Orkneys. And then I moved to America, and I'm living in Reno and traveling around doing the CRM over here for a bit, getting orientated because it's quite different. It's quite strange because I'm, what am I now? I'm almost 39. I'm 39 in a couple of weeks.
Nice.
To have to start again as a sort of, it's weird because I'm like a fresh-faced kid out of university who doesn't know a lot and has to learn all the methods again. At the same time, I'm a 39-year-old who's, you know, as disgruntled and pissed off as most archaeologists. So it's a bit tricky. And whilst I'm doing this, I'm doing a postgraduate study with one of the Irish colleges, and we'll be talking about that. So
yeah,
I'm working full-time and doing full-time college remotely, which is a weird combination, but it's just about working.
Yeah, so Stuart, that's great. We're going to get into, I hope we have time at the end of this to talk about some of your CRM stuff, because we had a great discussion on some of the differences between, you know, you're new in CRM here, but you've done CRM in Ireland, so it's a really good perspective. So we'll talk about that later. But for now, you sent us a bunch of images and that we have in the show notes. So if you want to pause this recording and go over, click. If you're using a podcast player, typically you can just click on the links that we have right on your screen there if you're on your phone or something like that, and then go over to the page for this and then take a look at some of the images that Stuart sent us. So Stuart, why don't you explain what you sent us and what that is? Like, what are we looking at?
Okay, so The project I'm doing is with IT Sligo, which is one of the smaller, it's not actually a university, it's a technical institute, but that doesn't really matter. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. And Sligo's a great little university. I actually went up there to try and recruit students, and they ended up recruiting me instead. One of my old friends from the CRM jobs is now lecturing there, and over the last couple of years we were doing a sort of hobby project together, and it's evolved into this study. So that's working with Dr. James Bonsall, who's he's a specialist in geophysics, and does some really amazing research on the challenges of using geophysics in soaking wet country like Ireland. Very technical stuff. And what we've been looking at is a system of, they're called signal defensible guard houses, is their official name, but they're the Coast Guard, not the Coast Guard. They're the signal stations set up around the Irish coast at the start of the 19th century. And Ireland had a whole series of invasions and threatened invasions. So the politics of this is, after the Reformation and through the 17th century, Ireland gets, although it's been occupied since 1169, there's been a presence in Ireland of English or British. I don't want to get into that too much because it is difficult. It's been a reasonably settled time. There's a Gaelic island and an old English island. And then after the Reformation and all the changes, you get this plantation of new Protestant English coming into Ireland en masse and repossessing all this land. And it creates the main source of tension that's still there today between the two countries, is this newer occupation, because they're getting rid of the Catholics, or they're taking the land deliberately off the Catholics and replacing them with Protestant landlords. And so you get, from the 1650s onwards, this series of struggles and uprisings where they're trying to get control of Ireland back for the Catholic Irish. Hmm. And the most threatening period of that is right at the end of the 18th century. So you've got a big invasion of French forces in 1796. And they come into Bantry Bay on the south coast of Ireland. And they get hit by a winter storm because for some reason they chose to invade in December. So they spent almost the whole month stuck in Bantry Bay. And the only reason they didn't get this massive army on shore was the wind was never in the right direction. And eventually the fleet gets broken up and has to go back to France. And they lose a number of ships, but no actual real fighting takes place. And they have another go then in 1798, and they invade twice in 1798. The first one is in August, and a small army does land, and they take over one of the English towns, Castle Bar, which is on the west coast, the northwest coast. And they meet up with some of the Irish rebels, and then they go off into the Irish Midlands, where there's a big battle, which they lose against the British army. And they're all dispersed. And then a third invasion happens in October, when this character, Wolftone, who you might know from the Irish music scene, the big band, the Wolftones, that sing rebel songs. And nice. If you're ever in Dublin, that Wolftone Quay is one side of the river. You know, the leader of the United Irishmen, and they fail to land. Again, they get caught in Lough Swilly on the northern coast, and there's a naval battle, and they surrender. Tony's taken off to Dublin to be hung, and he commits suicide rather than being hung. So that's what's going on. But these victories, or the failure of these invasions, is much more down to luck than anything else. It's just bad weather and bad timing. And so that causes a real panic, because the people running these rebellions are the United Irishmen, and it's a really progressive organization that wants an independent Ireland run on behalf of both Catholics and Protestants. And actually that sort of political aspect won't come round again for another 200 years, really. Mm-hmm. This idea that they could cooperate. And they're being supported by the French, who've obviously come through the revolution and the reign of terror, and it's just stabilizing a bit. Napoleon is just making those big moves, getting towards taking, seizing power, but he's still a general at this time. So you've got this amazing French, amazingly successful French military thing going on all across Europe. And really, when you look at it and you get into the histories, they did at the time talk about it as a world war, because it is happening in the colonies as well. It's happening on the Indian Ocean. It's happening in the Caribbean. There is a lot of fighting going on at this time. And the invasion of Ireland is key for an eventual invasion of England. So that's what the big worry is, that they'll not only just take Ireland, but they'll then use that as a base to invade England from the west. And so you get a huge program of fortifications going up around the Irish coast, starting about 1803. And lots of work has been done on the Martello Towers. These are quite famous around Europe and around the world. There's even a couple over here. There's a few in Canada, but in the Caribbean, they're quite popular. And these are these circular towers with cannon emplacements on the top of them, very strongly built with a bomb-proof bolt.
Jeez.
Brand new type of military architecture. And so they fortify the main bays of Ireland with these towers, and they add gun batteries and barrack buildings and a whole range of stuff. And that's reasonably well known. But what little work has been done about the signal stations that connected all these. And that's what we're looking at. So from Dublin, which, if you know Ireland, it's halfway up the east coast. It's really close to the midpoint of the east coast. And from there, they run a chain of signals all the way down the east coast, along the south coast, and all the way up the whole of the west coast, around the northwest corner, and then stop at the very northern tip of Ireland. And they use 81 signal stations. Now, they don't do the...
So, real quick, this is signals like Lord of the Rings type of thing, where they're up on the, like a big fire up on the mountaintops. So on top of these structures, they have something that you can see. I would presume fire, right? Is that what it is?
I don't know. Well, that's what a lot of people think. And they actually occasionally light signals, fire signals around the coast to celebrate this thing. And they did it last summer for an anniversary. They may have used fire signals at night, but the main signals were flag signals.
Ah, okay.
So there's a big mast with a 50-foot tall mast with all these flag signals on.
Okay.
Well, no one is going to invade a hostile coast in the middle of the night. So the chances of just smashing your ship against the shore is too big. And the same for very bad weather when it's foggy and heavy. You're just not going to approach these rocky shores.
Mm-hmm.
So it's invasions would happen on a good day, and that's when the flag signals would work. And I mean, I could talk more about the flag signals, because that's part of the evolution of all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to explain what the signal stations were first, if that's cool.
Yeah, I have a quick question too, based on this. You just mentioned that people recently were doing kind of a fire ceremony and celebrating these and relighting them. Are a number of the towers still standing, or are they all sort of archaeological ruins?
Now, there's one that's been properly reinstated and is in close to its original condition now. And that's as part of a museum on the old head of Kerry, where the Lusitania sank. So it's the museum for the Lusitania, and had some artifacts that have been dragged up. About, say, roughly half of them have fallen down or in very bad ruinous state, or have vanished altogether, and about a quarter of them reasonable, and then the last quarter are in really good condition. They're just missing the roofs and the timber elements, but the stone of these stations is still there. And what the stations are consisting of is a square, this signal defensible guardhouse, which is a square tower. It looks like a castle, a late medieval castle in miniature. So a very stout stone-built square tower with corner, like projecting turrets over the corners and over the doors, and then they're set inside a rectangular enclosure, a big walled enclosure, which would have had like an 8-foot wall around it. So one of the reasons they've survived well is because they're on either on islands or on very remote peninsulas where there aren't any heavy populations. So a few of them have been robbed out and, you know, the stones carted off. But mostly they've just been abandoned. And in fact, they spent all this money building these things. And they were built from 1804 through to 1806. And they're only in use for a couple of years. By 1808, they start abandoning them. They reuse them a bit in the War of 1812. Some of them seem to be recommissioned. There's actually American state-sanctioned piracy off of the Irish coast during that war, so they use them again. And then after that,
that's an alternative fact. We don't believe that.
Absolutely. That's just one way of seeing it.
Right?
Yeah.
Let me ask you real quick before we go to break here in a couple minutes. I'm looking at, I hope people are looking at the images that you sent us, because these are really good. You know, this one that we're looking at here is like, it's got like four stories, really. I see four real platforms and then kind of a mid-level one in the bottom story. Yeah. So were there like garrisons of people here, or was this just for the people that were basically manning it, that, you know, just like a handful of troops or something? Or were there a number of troops? Did they do other things in here? And then I guess when they started, you know, I'm really kind of surprised, like, people just didn't move into them, because they look like they'd be a halfway decent place to shelter or live, quite frankly, when they abandoned them.
Yeah, I mean, they're very well built. The interior, you've got like a little basement and then a ground floor room, which would have had the... these things were staffed by ex-seamen, pensioners or invalids. So you've got a small crew of the signalmen downstairs. And then on the ground floor, there's an office and the officers' quarters. And above that, a sort of attic, which we don't know a lot about. It may have had water tanks in. Okay. And then the roof. These things are overbuilt for their purposes. Mm-hmm. So with an 8-foot stone wall around them and that big tower... you know, that little garrison could hold off for a long time, but we're not sure. We haven't found any contemporary explanations for it, but we suspect strongly that they were built with the idea that they could be used during if there was another rebellion, that you'd then got 80-odd redoubts, you know, that British forces could retreat to if they got stuck or they got cut off. Mm-hmm. That they were all these strongly fortified positions that could hold. You know, you've got an enclosure that's 50 meters long or 30 meters long,
right,
and 20 meters wide, and this big tower, and there's other buildings inside it, so that they could be used in if the situation really descended. And I think that's why they were constructed in this style. But yeah, the actual day-to-day running was only about 6 people.
Hmm. Okay. Well, got lots more questions about this, but we're going to take a break real quick, and we'll come back in less than a minute.
Would you like to get more involved with archaeology? Are you looking for volunteer or internship opportunities? Are you already working on community or personal archiving projects and could use some helpful hints? Check out the Ideas portal, sponsored by Codify. Visit ideas.codify.com, a free and open community tool, and share your ideas, knowledge, and advice on select topics that will lead to vibrant opportunities and initiatives for all aspects of archaeology, from fieldwork to public service. All ideas are welcome, so visit ideas.codify.com today and make your voice heard. That's ideas.codify.com.
Okay, we're back. And so again, I'll stress again, I hope you're looking at the images for this on the show notes page, because these are really cool. It's not just the building, it's the kind of fortifications around it and things like that. So Stuart, you were alluding to, and I asked the question before, but I don't think we got into it. You know, you said they were possibly reused, like in the War of 1812, or some of them were anyway. But there's no, like, what kind of material culture do you find around these things? They're like, nobody was using them for just domestic use. No, nobody that lives nearby said, well, the army's not using it anymore, let's jump in there and make it our home. Because I would.
Yeah, well, what seems to have happened with them is they've got an amount of dressed stonework on the windows and the door. There's that wonderful door on the first floor.
Mm-hmm.
And that was accessed via a ladder. So once you're in, there was a retractable ladder. And it means that from the ground, you can't actually get into these buildings.
Hmm.
So what we found as we've gone from site to site is that this dressed stonework has all been taken and stripped out of the windows on the majority of the site. But then they bust through to provide ground floor access, because obviously the floors have gone. They take one of the ground floor windows and just open it up so it becomes a door. And you get these crazy sort of ragged holes on the corners, essentially, of the building,
mm-hmm.
where the local farmers have broken into it to let cattle in or to use it as a storage area and have that ground floor access. But it's the most dangerous looking thing you've ever seen, because you're going in and they've taken the corner of the building away.
Mm.
So, but they're not, for all their size, the interior space is only about 4 meters across. So it's just not that handy a space. There's a couple of them have been converted into holiday homes on the south coast. Now, I haven't seen any of those in person. I'm doing the northwest provinces. There's one that got turned into a lighthouse, so it's encased inside a lighthouse. That's on one of the Aran Islands off of Galway Bay. But generally, they're just abandoned. They were covered in slates, and all the slates have been robbed off them and used for roofs around there. So really, they were just plundered, but they're not a particularly practical building for other purposes, I guess.
Yeah, it sounds like not a whole lot was practical about it, because, like you said earlier, the way that they're constructed sounds like they were overbuilt. Like somebody almost either had too much money or was overcompensating or was planning on a much bigger conflict.
Well, we had all that money pouring in from India and places at the time, so they weren't skint, no.
So these are all being financed by Britain, right? By England? Mm-hmm. In the British government. Okay. They didn't make Ireland pay for them?
Yeah, they probably did.
Sorry. That was a terrible joke.
That's what we've come to understand how it happens. So what kind of now you've got a lot of these drawings here. What have you done archaeologically on these? Like, you guys say you visited these sites. What have you done from an archaeological standpoint? Just like recorded the buildings? Have you dropped in any units to done any excavating?
Yeah,
what's happened there?
What we've been trying to do is develop something we sort of tagged zero budget archaeology. And we're not the first people to have ever used the term, but what we mean by that is part of this project is an experiment in using new technology to record these buildings, which almost none of them have been previously recorded. The one that got reconstructed has been, and there's a couple of sketch plans of maybe two or three other sites out of the 80. So the goal was to go and create very good records of these things before they fall down, because the sea air is getting to them. It's dissolving the mortar, and without intervention at an expensive level, these are all going to fall down, I would say, in the next 50 years or so. So we wanted to get out and record them, and what we're doing is we didn't have any money, you see. It started off as just a hobby project that myself and James were involved with at the weekend. So we came up with the idea of using demo software and free-to-use software, and then just a recording scheme based on equipment we already had, stuff that will run on a simple laptop, stuff that you can use with a cheap digital camera and take the record. Using all the resources that now are available, like Google Earth and Bing Maps, to get the aerial imagery. So at each site, we're turning up and doing a simplified version of photogrammetry, where we take a load of overlapping photos of each wall face, and then use the perspective correction tool in PaintShop Pro to straighten up the angle, okay, so that we've got something that not disappearing and narrowing at the top. And from that, in AutoCAD, on the student license of AutoCAD, tracing over them and creating these very detailed elevations, internal and external elevation scene. And that's that's at a level of detail that we can then really interrogate the buildings and find out how they work. I was like, I think it was Audrey Horning talking about post-medieval or historic archaeology and saying it's an archaeology of surfaces because a lot of the work is with standing buildings. And I think that's definitely what we're doing. We're doing these, you haven't really got phasing as such, but there are all these details in the buildings that there's no record of. You know, there's very little written about these things. So we figured out that they're capturing rainwater off the roof and bringing it down. You can see a drainage channel built into the corner of the walls. We found that there's basements. There's no mention anywhere of them having basements, but they've all got basements. They've all got this weird attic space and this strange, there's like a mezzanine level on the ground floor. These two big, heavy shelves almost coming across the building. So we're making that sort of discovery because of how well this recording technique works. But what's great about it is you're able to go out with I can do them by myself. It only takes me an hour to record the buildings. I mean, it then takes me a week or two to process them. But in terms of field work, you're able to run out with just a small backpack, a ranging rod, a camera, a notepad, some measuring tapes, and create these elevations.
Sounds like you really benefit from some drone photography too, just
lovely.
To get up high.
And that's one of the limits of the method, that we can't get to the angles at the very tops of the buildings are difficult.
Well, I'll tell you what, you bring me out there this next summer, and I'll bring my drone with me, and we'll do it. I'm wondering, just kind of like a side thought that I've been having, what's access like on these things? You said there's a lot of them. So who owns them? I know Scotland had some things that I just wasn't used to, like the right to walk over or something like that. Like you could just like walk onto people's property and check stuff out, like all these old castles and things like that. That's not to say that the government owns them or something like that, but they are on private land, but you could walk up to them. Is it similar in Ireland?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, there's no real right to access land in Ireland as there would be in Scotland, but people are just very much more relaxed about it. So there's been the odd site where, you know, it's fenced off and we had to go and find the people and make arrangements. But generally, you're talking about open moorland and open upland peats and stuff. So it's not like there's any crop or anything that you're disturbing. The only thing that's out there will be sheep grazing on the stuff.
Right.
And, you know, people are pretty cool. You can just walk up to most of them. Very few of them have been incorporated into the tourist landscape, and that's something we'd like to address. That, you know, you can put a bit more work into access and let people go out there. But of course that brings in problems with the stability of the buildings. You know, the councils can't get involved in taking people out and suggesting they go to these places if the buildings themselves aren't safe to visit. So
how far along are you guys with the recording project like this? Like how many do you have left? What's your, if you could put an end on this phase of the project, you know, how far along are you?
Well, we've done all the field work for this phase. One of the things that's happened is, so we've done, I think there's 35 sites in our study area. So we've visited and recorded all of those. One of the things that's happened as we've done the project is the technology has changed. And so we started this back in 2009, I suppose. And three or four years ago, this 3D photogrammetry became available. AutoCAD 123D CAP, first one we're using, and we're using PhotoScan now. And the early sites, some of those we'd like to revisit and get sets of photos that we could use with the new software. But I think that's been really interesting in how quickly the technology is developing. And even if we did go back, there's no guarantee that by the time we've got this thing finished and handed in, we won't be out of date again anyway, because something else will have come along. And you mentioned drones. I mean, the idea of having a drone fly over one of these things was completely out of the question 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah,
I managed to get my first drone fly over one site this summer. You know, met a guy, I was doing some other work with him, and he happened to have a drone and flew over one of them for me. So again, that's hobby level equipment. I mean, I'd love to get a bit of a grant and get myself one of the Phantom models and go back and do some of these. But that's definitely a weird challenge that we can't keep up with how fast the technology is changing.
It sounds like with the amount of wind in the locations where you guys are at, that a lot of drones, unless you got the really expensive, heavier ones that could handle the wind speeds. The one I've got can handle maybe 30 miles an hour of wind and still maintain some really good stability. But it sounds like with those wind, I mean, honestly, kite photography would actually be really good
That'd
for
be
you guys.
Fun.
Because if you've always got the wind, it'd be really fun, wouldn't
it? That's got another advantage in that it's lightweight equipment. I mean, you're talking about access. Some of the you're hiking for an hour or more over pretty rough ground to get there. So, you know, your big heavy flight case for a drone might be a problem.
Oh my God, mine weighs a ton. I would never want to carry that more than like outside the trunk of a car. Yeah, that thing's enormous. And that you're totally right. But a kite with its rig and the handles and the camera and everything. I mean, you can stick in a small backpack and still have room for snacks and water.
You're on about being in Scotland, where the kite photography people have done wonderful work in Scotland, working with school groups and local groups. And that ties into what we're doing, that we want these methodologies to be repeatable by anyone, so other students can go out and use them. Mm-hmm. And local groups recording their own history will be able to use these methods, not have to invest a load of money in them, and be able to produce really good results. And kite photography being cheap is something we'll definitely have a look at in the later stages, even just to test it on a couple of sites and say there's more potential.
So besides going back and re-imaging some of these with newer technologies, what if money were no object, what would another phase of this project, what would you like to do next after you got some really good imagery on all these?
So Ireland is split into four provinces, and we've done the work on two of them. It would be nice to get the other two, which would be another 6 weeks or 8 weeks worth of work. But we haven't done any excavation, and that would be nice. One of these sites, again, the site that has been restored, has been excavated, and another one has had some work in the immediate proximity. But finding, you know, that there's certain elements, there's secondary buildings within these enclosures that we can only see as very low foundation for those up, and see what those buildings were actually used for. And it would be really nice. Funnily enough, the basements inside the towers, we don't know how far down they go, because at every example they're in built. So it'd be lovely to get down to the bottom of the basement and see if they had a proper floor in there, and maybe, you know, what artifacts might be in it to see what they were using that space for. So that would be the thing I'd love to do.
So though you haven't done archaeology, in the process of kind of scanning and recording these buildings, do you get evidence of the people who are living there? I know in a lot of military outposts and things like that, you get, you know, graffiti basically, and people carving their names into lintels and things like that. Do you find any of that?
Yeah, there's a little bit, but not very much. And it may be down to the having an officer present in the building at all times, that the men wouldn't be carving their names into too many things, because he's around to catch them, and you can sort of picture the scene shouting at them and saying, come on, own up, who wrote that?
And when it's your name, it's a little bit hard to say, well, I don't know.
No, well, Brian did it. Why does it say Paddy? And there's nothing, we've never found anything at any of the sites that you could say, oh, this is a part of the building or some artifact that goes with it. So whether, even if we did excavate, whether there'd be very, very scant traces of material culture. But you'd think, you know, 5 or 6 years of occupation, there must be something to dig up.
Yeah.
But we're not. We did talk about doing some trenches at one site, but nothing really came of it. And to be honest, just doing the work we've got is pretty time consuming. So,
well, before we get into something else, we're about a minute from the break, so I think we'll take it early, and we'll come back for the third segment and wrap up our discussion. Back in a second.
Archaeology and Ale is a free monthly talk presented by Archaeology in the City from the University of Sheffield Archaeology Department.
That's where the archaeology part of archaeology and ale comes from. As for the ale part, the talk is held upstairs at the Red Deer, a great local pub on Pitt Street in Sheffield, South Yorkshire, on the last Thursday of every month. If you're in Sheffield, do come along, and don't worry, non-ale alternatives are also available. If you can't make it to Sheffield, never fear. You can listen to the Archaeology and Ale Talk every month, right here on the Archaeology Podcast Network. And now, back to the show.
Okay, so we're back with our final segment with Stuart. And I guess while we've been talking about this, some of the images you have are some 3D reconstructions of the of one of the signal towers overlaid onto Google Earth. And you can see the fortifications around it, which led me to believe, or led me to think, are there any related structures or settlements to any of these signal towers? I know they're in very remote locations, so but are there anything around these besides the fortifications that were put up as a result of these people being here? You know, I doubt there's any like villages or anything, but you know, who knows? But is there anything related to these that you guys have seen in your research?
No, very much not. And I think one of the things they're doing here is there's a process that goes on in this time period of taming the coast. Mm-hmm. That's what they termed in Scotland with the lighthouses, where you've got these very remote areas that the government have no control over, no effective control over. And this is part of the process of getting that land sort of more enmeshed in state control. So you get these, and then the follow-up, within about 20 years, they're putting up the Coast Guard stations all around the coast. And the Coast Guards aren't like Baywatch. You know, they're not there to stop people drowning. They're there to control trade and stop people smuggling and make sure they're paying their tariffs and their taxes. Mm-hmm. So, again, and not a very welcome presence being imposed on these very autonomous, very remote areas. So yeah.
That may have been the first Baywatch reference on the Archaeology Podcast Network. I'm glad to have it though. Nice. Well, Stuart, is there anything else you know, that any links we can put in that you want people to go check out that we can put down on the show notes page for this site?
Yeah, we've got an ArcGIS online database. Again, more free software. Mm-hmm. So there's an interactive map that people can look up, and they can see the sites we've done and some photos of the different sites. And over time, that's going to become a really, we're going to put a lot more detail into that. So that's one to sort of keep an eye on if people are interested in these things.
Okay. Yeah. So if anybody wants to check that out, definitely check the links in the show notes. And like I've said before, check out the pictures associated with this, because they got some really cool stuff up there, some really cool, really highly detailed drawings. So anybody sitting out there with a fat checkbook that wants to write Stuart a check to go and do these, take a look at those images. You'll see what you get out of it.
I think you're advertising on the wrong platform for that.
Yeah, probably. All right. Well, that was really fascinating. I think in the last maybe 15 minutes here, we can go into a little bit of our discussion that we had the other day on some of the differences between cultural resource management in the United States and in Ireland. Or in the UK, I should say, where you've worked. And like you were kind of alluding to in the beginning, you know, you had quite a bit of experience, you know, over in the UK doing different things. But now you come over here and you're back to square one, which is how we like to do things. Yeah. I mean, that just reminds me of a guy that I worked for on, I think it was my second project ever. You know, he's probably at the time in his late 50s, I think, has a master's degree. He was a project manager on this project, doing all these things. And it was my wife's third project ever in CRM. And she was also just a tech on this project. But then, you know, 5 years later, he decides he wants a change of scenery and a change of venue and decides to come work in the Great Basin in CRM. Well, him and his 20 years of experience got him exactly a field tech job. And she was his boss. She was his crew chief on that project, because that's how we like to do things, right? Your experience means nothing. So you know, we know that you've got some experience over here. You've worked in a couple different areas here in Nevada and around. But what was your CRM experience like in the UK? Where in the UK have you done commercial archaeology?
Well, I've actually not done much in the UK. I've done a bit, like 6 months in the Fens of East Anglia, which was a new environment for me. That was quite late in the States. And Northern Ireland, I did a lot of work up there. Mm-hmm. Most of my commercial stuff was in the Irish Republic, though. So that's where, you know, my heart or the most of my experience in commercial work was done on motorway projects, freeways, in the Republic.
Okay. And one of the interesting things I thought when we were having our discussion is the type of work that's done over there. Because it's not a lot of big large scale pedestrian survey like we do here in the West Coast of the United States, you know, these massive projects where you're just walking in the desert, or even large projects where you're shovel testing and things like that. Can you describe for our listeners a little bit what a typical project might be like in your experience over on that side?
Yeah, okay. So I think there's a big difference in scale of what the work is. That's the most obvious bit to me. But over here with this work out in Nevada, where you're doing whole mountain ranges or valley systems, and you're looking at these great big areas, and you're working in little crews spread out across the landscape looking for artifacts, really. We would be working in Ireland on a much different system, where you're looking at the footprint of the impact of the development. So if you're doing a motorway, it's an 80 meter wide strip. It might go 20 or 30 miles or 50 or 60 miles on the bigger one, or a gas pipeline or anything like that. But you've got these linear footprints, and you're going to try and dig up every piece of archaeology you encounter along that narrow little strip. So the phases involved are quite different. We do a lot of historic research and aerial photography and geophysics before even moving into the area. So we've got an idea of what's there, and then we're doing this test trenching regime where you mechanically excavate a trench the whole way along one of these areas with offsets at 90 degrees all the way along. So you're digging up 10% of this, whatever the area is, and you know, it's big. You're digging up 10%, having a look for actual physical remains. There's much less emphasis on artifacts. We're really interested in finding pits and ditches and walls and banks and things that have been constructed. And they're very visible given the type of geology you have in Ireland and the agricultural regime. It's quite conducive to these things surviving. Again, quite different from Nevada, where, you know, people will be working their whole careers out here without really ever seeing a clear house.
Right.
I understand it. You know, that these things just aren't showing up. And then when you're excavating, you're finding one of these sites along, and your team will be assigned to a particular site along one of these routeways. And then depending on the size of it, you might spend 8 months there, or you know, 3 weeks, 2 weeks, 8 months, a year, 18 months isn't unheard of. And you're just working with a big crew of people in a small space that's, you know, your site might be 200 meters long and 80 meters wide that's defined as this site. And then you're just going to slowly clear out the area of the archaeological deposit through the excavation. Mm-hmm. But it's very much social, it seems to me, where you've got 40 or 50 people working in a team and all on that particular site together. As opposed to these, even when you've got multiple crews surveying in Nevada, everyone just meets up in the morning and then disappears, and you see the same three people for the rest of the day.
Yeah.
And then you drive home together. So that's quite different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I must say that I can't emphasize enough how the fitness requirements seem to be much higher over here. This idea of walking 12, 15 miles a day every day, and over rough ground and steep terrain.
And higher elevations.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm tremendously impressed with the hard work and the effort people put into it here. I'd like to see more buildings.
Well, you have to see the mining complexes, I guess. Sometimes there's buildings left. You know, but most of the time, you're right, there isn't. And part of that reason is because even when you think you're out in the middle of nowhere in Nevada, somebody lives near there, whether it was, you know, early settlers or Native Americans that have been there forever. You know, as soon as these mines and these other things are abandoned, just like your signal towers, the material's repurposed. You know, people come by and they take the wood because it's been seasoned out in the desert and it's not going to warp anymore, and it's actually decent wood now, and then they can use it for other things, even the nails.
And then they
shoot
up whatever's remains.
Exactly. Yeah, whatever wasn't used for construction, it's got bullet holes in it. So, yeah, exactly. So, well, that's cool. It's definitely a different environment out here. And you know, the thing I like about the United States, particularly, I've worked in just about every region in the continental U.S. I haven't worked in Alaska or Hawaii, but I've worked in the Northeast, you know, Southeast, Northwest, Southwest, Great Basin, California, Midwest. I've worked in, you know, most of these different areas, but we really run the gamut on different things. And it's very, very different archaeology, you know, say here in the Great Basin, like what you're talking about. People don't even understand what you're saying over in the East Coast, because they're not going to walk 12 miles in a day, but they are going to dig 80 shovel tests in a day.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, and that's got its own special kind of hell associated with it.
Yeah. I did a little bit of that in Illinois. And
oh my God.
That almost had me going back on a plane to Ireland.
For good reason.
Yeah. It didn't help that it was my first job and it was December.
Oh my God. Oh. Yeah.
That was my first contract job too. It was shovel tests and skim shoveling in December in the Midwest.
Oh my God.
And it really does. You decide if you're going to stay in archaeology or not.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty quickly.
Yeah, I bet there's a lot of people that don't make their first 6 months.
Yes.
Well, that though, that's real quick. That's one of the things I love about CRM archaeology. And that's what I try to tell new people. I was like, listen, if you hate the job you're in right now, simply quit and move. Just go somewhere else, work in another region, work another job. You know, the one you're on might suck right now, but there's a good one right around the corner. I promise. That's a huge lie, but I promise anyway. So anyway.
No, I was just intrigued by, I think there's a big difference in the United States and, you know, the UK between the acceptance and reliance on geophysics and contract archaeology. Chris, what are your thoughts on that? Because the companies that I've worked for, a lot of them wanted to do more geophysics and do GPR and things like that, but just, you know, the funds weren't necessarily there, and it's I think academia has embraced it a lot more than the contract world here.
Well, and you nailed it. It's money. You know, we barely have, with the competition for projects, we barely have the money to be able to say we're going to get this done within this time frame and within this price range. And if there's any left over, you know, it's simply just to be able to keep the company afloat. I mean, I feel like a lot of firms that are some of the smaller firms that don't have the larger engineering firm enveloped around them to help them pay for things. I mean, really, they're just making payroll in a lot of cases. Now, that's not to say every firm. There are some places that are really have a high research emphasis, and they're able to pull that off because they have the size to do that. You know, it comes down to two things: money and time. Because even if you do have the money, even if you do convince your developer or whatever that you're, you know, hey, I want to do this other big GPR study or something like that, they're like, great, you're dragging what across the ground? Well, I've got a bulldozer sitting there getting charged $300 an hour waiting for you to do that. You know, because they, you know, we're the last step usually for them to come in and do their construction. So even if you do have the money, if you have your own money, your own extra money, you may not have the time to do what you want to do.
Yeah.
Simply because of the time frame. Now, that being said, out here on the West Coast, I feel like we have more of an opportunity to do something like that because, you know, we are, like Stuart said, we are clearing large sections of land. So we can clear out a whole swath of land for a developer to do whatever they want in, like if it's exploration mining or something like that. And then on this tiny corner over here, we found this fantastic site. You know, they might let us get some more time and spend some more money to do some more interesting geophysical type stuff if we have the time and resources to do that. So, but on the East Coast, you're working with much smaller properties, and you know, there's literally a fleet of bulldozers waiting to come in right after you. So I think that's the big thing.
That's interesting about the money, because one of the reasons that it's done, and it's done normally a year or two in advance of the actual construction taking place, it's the state agencies that are the organizing the work want it done, because the geophysics gives you such a good idea of what's there.
Mm-hmm.
It makes scheduling easier. So it found to be cost effective in the terms that, yeah, you pay some money, but now we've got we're able to allot the right amount of time and resources to an area in advance because we have a clue what is there, you know, rather than going in completely blinded.
You nailed it, Stuart, because that's the thing that people can't see. It's the same old argument that we make for people going paperless over here. They're like, well, I don't have the money to look into tablets and do these things. We're like, listen, you can't afford not to do this. And it's the same argument. My friend Dan Bigman, who owns Bigman Geophysical over in the East Coast, you know, that's his whole point. He's like, listen, it doesn't cost extra to do a GPR study of this whole thing because it will actually limit the amount of work that you have to do because we determined through non-destructive methods that there's actually nothing over there. So, you know, here, dig here instead because there's actually something here, you know, versus the rest of the landscape. So you're totally right. Plus, Stuart, maybe you can comment on this in the last couple minutes we have here. I've heard this before and I totally believe it, but I think Time Team did a lot to alert the public in the UK in general to elevate their knowledge of what certain geophysical methods are, and so, you know, a developer can't just get around something because they know the value of these things because of Time Team's success in educating people about that.
Oh, undoubtedly.
Yeah.
You know, It's weird to think things like magnetic susceptibility are part of common knowledge now, and that is only time to, you know?
Yeah, and that's fantastic.
And and of course, you know, the thing with geophysics, when you're hitting good archaeology, is it produces such a clear image, and you can show people, you know, without digging it up and quickly, what these things look like. So they're great for press releases and visually, all that stuff that's come out of Stonehenge recently. You know, the Riverside project, hundreds of new sites found with the geophysics, and it goes straight into the newspaper because it looks really good.
Yeah, exactly. Well, hopefully, I wish our version of Time Team had more. More public success. You know, we've talked to we've talked on the CRM Archaeology podcast to the hosts of Time Team a few years ago, and they just didn't get the funding, you know, and that's tied to ratings in the public and things like that, which is really disappointing. So but hopefully sometime in the future we'll have another show similar to that where we can have the same level of education over here in the United States, so we're not surprised when, you know, Native Americans are upset about a pipeline going through their land. You know, we understand why they're upset. Mm-hmm. Anyway, thanks a lot, Stuart, for coming on. This is a really fascinating discussion. These signal towers are amazing, and I'm looking forward to seeing more things come out of that. Thanks for coming on the show.
Okay, thanks very much for having me.
All right, and join us next time. We got some more fantastic interviews lined up, and thanks for listening to the Archaeology Show, and be sure to check out the show notes for this episode. Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. This show is edited by Christopher Sims of the Go Dig a Hole podcast. Go check it out. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
If you like this podcast, you might be interested in other podcasts that focus on the humanities. In fact, if you search Twitter for the hashtag #HumanitiesPodcasts, you'll find plenty of shows on history, language, literature, philosophy, art, and more. These are podcasts by people who enjoy telling stories, exploring the arts in our world, and who want to share their knowledge. Some examples of podcasts you'll find are Go Dig a Hole, an archaeology podcast, the Trojan War podcast, which retells the classic myth, and As We Like It, where three friends talk about film adaptions of Shakespeare. Search the hashtag Humanities Podcast today or follow Humanities Podcasters on Twitter. And if you're a Humanities Podcaster, use the hashtag in your tweets so others can find you.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for more info.